Hello, everyone. It is Saturday. It is almost 3 o'clock, and that means that it is time for Air Olympia. Anarchist news and analysis from Olympia of the Cascades. On this week's show, or on today's show, one of this week's show, we are joined by a very special guest, a local downtowner, Boone. And Boonosaur, as I like to call him, is going to tell us some cool stuff about what he feels the city's, you know, how he feels about the city's comprehensive plan and how the comprehensive plan relates to the Olympia area homeless. And we're going to have a call-in from Henry Noble from the Freedom Socialist Party in Seattle. And we're going to talk about some other really cool stuff. So stick around. This is Air Olympia. Yeah, welcome to Air Olympia, everyone. Anarchist news and analysis from Olympia, Washington, Cascadia. And we're going to get into a few headlines from the day, from the week. On March 10th, Jeremy Pulaski from The Olympian wrote, Olympia City Councilman Joe Heyer pleaded not guilty to three drug felonies Tuesday, and his attorney suggested in a court filing that a trusted political mentor of Heyer entrapped him into selling marijuana twice while the mentor was working as an undercover informant. So, while I might not be in agreement with Joe Heyer's politics, I must say that selling, you know, $20 worth of marijuana or whatever it was is not a jailable offense. And so Air Olympia sends our best regards and wishes to Joe Heyer and Joe Heyer's family. And also, this was published on March 12th. As many of you may know, there was a Olympia City Council meeting Tuesday, and this meeting did a whole lot to decide the fate of the downtown isthmus. Now, what is the downtown isthmus, you might ask? Well, the downtown isthmus is the narrow strip of land which connects downtown to the west side. And what Triway Enterprises is planning to do is pressure the Olympia City Council to rezone that land so that they can build a 90-foot tower on it, so that they can rezone the building height restrictions to 90 feet, and they want to build a upscale condominium thing called the Lorita Passage. And this is a part of the Bring a Vibrant Economy section of the Olympia City Council's comprehensive plan. And how this relates to bringing a vibrant economy to Olympia is, well, right now, there's not a whole lot of people with a whole lot of money in Olympia. So what you have to do if you want to have a vibrant local economy is you have to build something where the people with money will want to live. And then you have to move the people into that thing so that they can come downtown and spend all the money. So Tuesday night, they were going to decide whether or not to overturn the interim decision that they made in January to revert building height limits to 35 feet on the isthmus. Now, building height limits before were at 35 feet, but there was a decision in, I believe it was 2008. There was a decision to overturn this and move building height limits to about 90 feet so that the Triway could have the go-ahead to build Lorita Passage on the isthmus. And then in January of this year, they reverted height limits back to 35 feet. This was a pretty overwhelming decision in the city council, and so this is probably going to force Triway. This is probably going to force Triways into a lawsuit with certain members of the Olympia community over whether or not on the isthmus, because Triway says that no matter what the new city council decides, they still have the go-ahead to build on the isthmus, because the right to build on that land was given to them during a different zoning. You know, it was given to them while they were under a 90-foot zoning. And so even if they decide to turn it back to 35 feet, they can still build it because of all that. But this is going to force them into a lawsuit with certain people. And that lawsuit is more than likely going to happen because Tuesday night they decided to keep the zoning, the height limit on the isthmus at 35 feet. And someone put forth a motion. I believe it was, a motion was put forth to discuss and do research about whether or not having housing on the isthmus would be a good idea, and this motion failed 4-3. So it's looking like the height limit on the isthmus is going to stay at 35 feet, which will push Triways into a lawsuit with certain members of the Olympia community. And this article was written by Matt Batchelor and published March 12th of 2010 in the Olympian. And if you would like to help, city council meeting was on Tuesday night, and this article wasn't written until Friday. And so I am of the opinion that if city council is going to be making all these decisions that determine like the fate of the Olympian community, and all these decisions are going to be very controversial and, you know, completely in opposition to what I believe to be and many believe to be the established consensus here in Olympia, then someone needs to be covering city council, and that someone needs to have an article written the next day and not on Friday about it. And so if you would like to join the Air Olympia news team and help us study, help us cover the fate of the isthmus, the Olympia comprehensive plan, and all of this stuff in a real, legitimate kind of way, then write Air Olympia at riseup.net or show up to our meeting next Friday at 3:30 here at Media Island International. And the comprehensive plan is a very, very, very in-depth little bit of policy that the Olympia City Council is trying to put forward. And what does the plan involve? Well, it involves bringing a vibrant economy to Olympia. This is a vibrant, independent, green economy. That's what they want to bring to Olympia. Engaging citizens. Attend to revenue needs to support core services. The main thing in this section of the comprehensive plan that that catches my eye is to complete City Hall by the end of 2010, and protect and improve the environment, improve water quality in the Bud Inlet, and deploy RC Water Capital Campus and the West Side. And so part of the vibrant economy, bringing a vibrant economy to Olympia section of the comprehensive plan, involves doing away with certain elements of the Olympian culture that might not contribute to a vibrant, green, capitalist, like gentrified economy. And some of those certain elements are the homeless culture here in Olympia. And Thursday, some representatives from the Olympia Planning Commission or the Olympia City Council and local law enforcement came to Community Youth Services, where, you know, it's a pretty successful program that offers a lot of vital services to local homeless youth and at-risk youth. And they basically laid out a lot of their intentions for this coming year. And a lot of those intentions are basically like get the homeless people out of Olympia. They're gonna be going down the Woodland Trail. They're gonna be raiding a bunch of camps at the Woodland Trail. I heard this from the horse's mouth. They're going to be working with local businesses about how to deal with the homeless, how to in some cases it is kind of been described to me as how to treat the homeless with decency. In other cases it has been described to me as how to sort of deal with the homeless problem in whatever ways. And how do you know, if they want to have a vibrant economy and have people moving into Lorita Passage, walking around, spending, you know, thousands of dollars a day or whatever, then they're going to have to, like, do away with a lot of these homeless people who are going to scare a lot of those folks off. And what they've done is they have done a series of tests, a series of studies, data mining studies, to find out exactly how many homeless people there are in Olympia. And the doing away with, you know, getting the homeless out of Olympia or whatever, which, you know, may or may not be their intention. It, you know, I'm sure that someone could call me up right now, 352-1646, and say, you know, D, it's not really the city council or the local law enforcement's intention to completely get rid of the homeless in Olympia. But when they're going up the Woodland Trail, which is one of the only large wooded areas that is in immediate access walking distance to downtown, and they're saying that they're going to be raiding camps up there, they're going to be doing all these things, they're working with local businesses about how to deal with the homeless problem. That kind of tells me that, considering that the Woodland Trail has been kind of off limits for law enforcement agencies in the past, you know, it tells me that they're coming up with a different idea about this, you know, and they're building City Hall downtown. They're trying to bring more law enforcement, rational, gentrified presence downtown. And, you know, it wouldn't really be so bad if they wanted to do away with the homeless by, like, making the economy better so that the homeless wouldn't be homeless anymore. But as things are going, with the budget cuts and with all the, you know, the budgets being cut to services which provide outreach for homeless people and all of this, a lot more people are becoming homeless than before. And this is very apparent by a lot of these statistics that I have right here. You see in, let's see, this is the 2007 through 2010 school year homeless student counts by district. And in 2007, there were 191 homeless students in North Thurston, at North Thurston High School, I guess. Our North Thurston School District had 191 homeless students. Olympia had 266. In 2008, North Thurston had 213. Olympia had 284. 2009, North had 219. Olympia had 239. Numbers are still pretty close. 2010, North Thurston has 285. Olympia this year had 548 homeless high school students in the district. Okay, that's 129% increase. And so this means that at the time that they're talking about, you know, clearing out the Woodland Trail, doing all these things to get rid of homeless people, there's 129% increase in the homeless population among high school students. And so these aren't, like, you know, 40-year-old freaking wino Ted who always wants a quarter and smells really bad that they're trying to clean off of the streets. These are young kids that they're trying to clean off the streets, you know? And the fact that they're cutting all of these programs that would help these young kids mean that these young kids aren't going to have anywhere to go. And it's not like they can go live with their parents, because their parents don't have any jobs, you know? And it's not like they can go and they can work really hard in school and get a good education and go to college and do something about it, because they're cutting the funding to freaking higher education and even high schools and stuff too. So this just doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. It's like they're cutting all the funding of these things, which is causing an influx of homeless people, and then at the same time they're doing these things to try to run the homeless people out. So what do you think about this, Boone? How is this going to end up?
As a person that could have a very corporate mind at the same time, as a person that could actually look through most of this, what I see is going on is a Darwinism effect, and I actually see you all through it. And I'm not even sure if I should be saying this on the air, but I see what they're trying to do. They're trying to cause a gentrification, as you say, but they're also trying to do Darwinism effect of making the perfect human. Most of these people are probably either subconsciously or consciously getting kicked out of high school and being forced into homelessness because they're not going to be seen as what is known as a perfect human prototype. However, in my opinion, if they finally get to the point where they want it, there will always be a cog in the machine. And if you are going to be that cog, please do it well, because these are people that do need hope. These are people that are homeless, and they have no reason to be this way. You might look at a homeless person like, oh my God, he's smelly, he looks bad, and like he doesn't have anything else. But think of a life where you live that day. But if the best thing I can do is ask yourself to put yourself in those shoes for one day of that person's life. I mean, yes, you might have everything. You might even have a small job. But until you've had to actually live that life, you might never see it through their eyes.
And Boone, you live that life every day, don't you?
I have, and I feel there's a lot of reasons why I have to live this way myself. It's a very hungry world out there. It's a very hungry world to destroy what it's set out to create, which is peace. I don't believe it's peace. I believe it's war. I wish and pray for these people daily as far as myself. But this Woodland Trail stuff, this has gone way too far. Even in the older days, back in when it was an uncivilized place, say back in the mid 1800s or whatever, at least these people would have the woods as a refuge. And now you're taking this away from them.
And if they clean out the Woodland Trail and they say that homeless people can't be sleeping, on the streets anymore and all this kind of stuff, like, where are you and everyone gonna go?
I'm just going to have to keep traveling until I can find something. I've been working forever trying to find any kind of decent type of employment that I can, and it seems to be more and more that it's not going to end up that way. We have to, if anything, if you're homeless and you have a chance to listen to this, I'd like to have a way for us all to sustain ourselves through ourselves. I mean, just be kind to each other and figure out a way to work this shit out, because it's getting worse and worse daily.
The FCC exists, everyone.
Oh, sorry.
Boone just said the S word. You might have thought that the FCC blinked out of existence, but they do still exist. And also, you mentioned something about – it's okay. You mentioned something about Darwinism. Do you think – now, this is your opinion. This is not Air Olympia or my opinion. It may or may not be Air Olympia's opinion, but this is an editorial section of this show, and you were saying that you think that the way that they are planning to do all these things to kind of push people into the streets and then do all these things to push them off of the streets they've just pushed them into is sort of might have some elements of social Darwinism behind it. So could you
I think it's just maybe a more or less a way to eradicate some of them. I think we're looking at a day and age where we're going to want plastic. Huge corporations want people that can just buy when they're told to buy, when to buy it, how to buy it, and don't think for themselves whatsoever. I fear that we're getting more and more towards a day where if you do think for yourself whatsoever, you're going to be seen as an unneeded, just waste, human waste.
And it's a sad day when all of this stuff starts happening, when there's not any jobs. And there's not any funding to the institutions which would provide outreach and relief for those people who are being pushed out into the streets. And then at the same time, when they're trying to clean up the streets, even though I'm sure they are aware that it is the policies that they have set forth which have caused an influx of homeless people to be. You were saying that you wish that all the homeless people would come together and kind of take it upon themselves to do something about this, and that's going to take a lot of strength, isn't it?
I think it's what's going to have to happen. I don't think anything else can happen at this point. I mean, I think we're coming to a point where we're going to have to start relying on each other more than we can do anything else. And the sad thing about that is, if anything like this is, if this isn't just a schizo thought of mine, if this is what's really happening, if we're really trying to make this plastic land of plastic people and we're getting rid of all these other fantastic people, the saddest part to me of that is that most of the most brilliant writers of history have gone through struggles and have needed help. Most of the most brilliant minds, most of the people that have the best stories to tell, and people that aren't just robots. Those are the people I feel are being forced into the streets, and those are the people that are going to need help. I just don't like the way shit's going. FCC, sorry, the way stuff's going in general.
It's fine. You can't say that on Air Olympia, but no one's gonna be really mad at you. But it is a really scary time, and a lot of people might be out there, and they might be confused about D, I hear you, man, but what's so wrong with, like, an independent economy? What's so bad about a vibrant economy? I mean, everyone I've heard from the city council says that they want a vibrant, like, local green economy, and how can this be bad? How can completely vicious and avaricious capitalist people, as a lot of these statistics that you're reading off kind of might lead one to think the people behind this are, how can they be down for green economic practices and local economy and still be racist and classist and sexist, like you say and like you keep saying on Air Olympia? Well,
Can I say something about that?
Yeah.
The thing I've got to say about that is that these are people that are very crafty. I mean, and these aren't just people. There's not just a they. They're corporate whores is what I'll call them.
Well,
Am I allowed to say that on SEC?
I'm going to have to cut you off here, Boone. I'm sorry. You can talk more. We'll have more time to talk at the end of the show. But, basically, what you have to remember is that people who are concerned with enslaving people and all these sorts of things, you know, who get into government because they want to procure benefit for themselves and those who they see as being like them, they are concerned with comfort and quality of life above all things. And so does like organic medicine, organic food, sustainable agriculture, local independently run economy, do all these things make for a higher quality of life than having a McDonald's, a Starbucks, and a Walmart on every corner? You bet. And so there you have it. And like you said, Boone, we're going to have a whole lot of strength to deal with all of this. And one person whose story can bring us a whole lot of strength is Rachel Corrie. And Democracy Now! Made a podcast about it this week, and here we go. So be strong, folks. Be strong like Rachel Corrie.
Rachel Corrie's posthumous day in court. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With my weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. An unusual trial begins in Israel this week, and people around the world will be watching closely. It involves the tragic death of a 23-year-old American student named Rachel Corrie. On March 16, 2003, she was crushed to death by an Israeli military bulldozer. Rachel was volunteering with the group International Solidarity Movement, known as ISM, which formed after Israel and the United States rejected a proposal by then-United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights Mary Robinson to place international human rights monitors in the occupied territories. The ISM defines itself as a, quote, Palestinian-led movement committed to resisting the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land using nonviolent direct action methods and principles. Israel was building a large steel wall to separate Rafah from Egypt and was bulldozing homes and gardens to create a buffer zone. Rachel Corrie and seven other ISM activists responded to a call on that March day to protect the home of the Nasrallah family, which was being threatened with demolition by two of the armored Israeli military bulldozers made by the U.S. company Caterpillar. Cindy Corrie, Rachel's mother, related what happened.
The bulldozer proceeded toward Rachel, that she took a position indicating that she was not going to move. She was in her orange jacket. When it kept coming, she rose on the mound, and the eyewitnesses testified that her head rose above the top of the blade of the bulldozer so she could clearly be seen, but the bulldozer continued and proceeded over her. And so that it was covering her body. It stopped and reversed, according to the eyewitness testimonies, without lifting its blade, so backed over her once again. Her friends were screaming at the bulldozer drivers through this to stop. They rushed to her, of course, and she said to them, "I think my back is broken," and those were her final words.
Shortly after Rachel's death, the Corries met with the Bush State Department. It was there that the idea of a civil lawsuit was first presented by Secretary of State Colin Powell's own chief of staff, Lawrence B. Wilkerson. Craig Corrie, Rachel's father, recalled.
Wilkerson, so chief of staff to Colin Powell, turned to me and he said, "If it was my daughter, I'd sue them. I don't care about money. I wouldn't care about anything. I would sue the state of Israel."
Ultimately, this is what the Corrie family did. just before heading to JFK Airport in New York to attend the trial in Haifa, Israel. Craig Corey told me about the lawsuit.
This is the culmination, really, of 7 years of our family searching for some sort of justice in the killing of Rachel. And we've tried to do that through diplomatic means, and we've asked for a U.S.-led investigation into Rachel's killing. We've also understand that the Israelis, through Prime Minister Sharon, promised President Bush a thorough, credible, and transparent investigation into Rachel's killing. But by our own government's measure, that has not happened. So we're left with simply a civil lawsuit. So we're accusing the state of Israel of either intentionally killing Rachel or guilty of gross negligence in her killing.
According to a Human Rights Watch report from 2005, Israel's, quote, investigations into Corey's killing fell far short of the transparency, impartiality, and thoroughness required by international law. The civil trial, Craig Corey says, is not about monetary damages, but discovering information.
Some way, like Desmond Tutu talks about, of mending the tear in society. And I think it's more like a wound in your arm, and to expect that one half of a wound would heal and the other half stay unhealed is impossible.
The Coreys never speak solely about their daughter, but about the plight of the Palestinians and the Israeli siege of Gaza. According to the latest figures of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, 24,145 houses have been demolished in the occupied territory since 1967, including the 4,247 that the United Nations estimated were destroyed during Operation Cast Lead, the name Israel gave to its military assault on Gaza in December 2008 and January 2009. Of course, more than houses were destroyed there. More than 1,400 Palestinians and 13 Israelis were killed. The Coreys also express concern about the psychological toll exacted on Israeli soldiers. This, again, is Craig Corey.
We lost Rachel, and that hurts every day. But that bulldozer driver lost a lot of his humanity when he crushed Rachel. We're told by Beth Selim, for instance, that in 2004, I believe, the highest, the cause proportionally of the of deaths among Israeli soldiers, the highest one is suicide. There's a big toll to soldiers.
The trial begins during the same week that Joe Biden makes his first trip to Israel as vice president. As chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Biden sought answers on the death of Rachel Corey during the confirmation hearings for U.S. Ambassador to Israel James Cunningham. Biden knows the pain of losing a daughter. His own daughter was killed with his first wife in a car accident in 1972. The Coreys are calling on people around the world to stand with them on March 16th, the anniversary of Rachel's death, for truth, accountability, and justice.
Beth Selim and Human Rights Watch and other organizations have talked about the impunity that the Israeli military enjoys because of lack of accountability through the courts and in other ways. And I hope that people will be visible to say, we've had enough of this, and to call for accountability for Rachel, but to link it to these other larger issues.
I'm Amy Good.
Yep, and this Tuesday, March 16th, will no doubt be a somber day in Olympia. But as much fighting as we've been doing across the globe, and especially here in Olympia in regards to the protests against the budget cuts on Evergreen Campus and the protests against the budget cuts at the Capitol and everywhere else, I don't think that Rachel Corey or anyone else who is smart, and I consider Rachel Corey to be a smart person, would want us to spend this Tuesday, March 16th in mourning, but rather we should use the opportunity to gather strength, because March 20th, there is an anti-war rally down in L.A., and you might be saying, why am I talking about an anti-war rally down in L.A.? What does that have to do? Well, the war, everybody's running around talking about, we ain't got no money for healthcare. We ain't got no money for education. The reason but is because they're sending all the money that they would send to that to war. Okay, so if we want to rally to save basic health, higher education, all of these things, we're going to have to rally to end the war. And that's what Rachel Corey was trying to do, and that's what we need to be trying to do right now. So let's have some strong thoughts and action, and stand in solidarity with our brothers and sisters all over the world and end war worldwide. And that is the only way that we're going to have enough resources to fund these things that we need, because as long as these resources are being sent to war, they're not going to be spent on what they need to be spent on. So here's Jim Page with I'd Rather Be Dancing, more about Rachel Corrie's story. And our hearts and blessings and everything else go out to the family of Rachel Corrie and everyone else this Tuesday, March 16th.
I was always the one, I could never stand idly by and watch while the bullies beat up on the weaker ones. I had to do something to try, and I never gave up on people, that we could be better somehow. Morality's compass, you gave it to me, and I still follow it now. Well, I couldn't stop thinking about it, I couldn't get it out of my mind. The pictures, the stories, the plight of the people in occupied Palestine, and how my government makes me complicit with the political aid that they send. So I packed up my bags and I headed to Rafah to work with the ISN. And I'd rather be dancing and falling in love, but if I can just watch from a distance, then what am I made of? Mama, these people are so good to me, they treat me like I'm one of their own. They feed me and see to my needs and let me sleep in their homes. And Papa, their lives are so hard, the gunshots every night, the strip searches, roadblocks, humiliations. Papa, it just isn't right. Well, I can feel my privilege around me, it's there in my American face. I could wave my passport around like a flag and I would be safe in this place. For these child soldiers of Israel, they look like the boys back home. And if it wasn't for American money, they'd have to leave these people alone. And I'd rather be dancing, dancing to Pat Benatar. Oh, but somebody has to do something about it, and here we are. Coming today, they're like tanks with bulldozer blades. The name on the side says Caterpillar, and that means they're American made. Well, I am American too, and I'll be where everybody can see. So if they wanna run over those houses today, they're gonna have to run over me. Well, it's dangerous taking a stand, but it's dangerous running away. Sometimes you have to face up to the danger, there is just no other way. But there are such beautiful dreams I have seen in the eyes of a child. If I can just make one little difference, then I think my life is worthwhile. And I'd rather be dancing, but instead I'm saying goodbye. But we'll meet again when it's over, don't cry. And I'd rather be dancing, surely we'd all rather be. And someday we'll dance in a world that's peaceful and
Hello, everyone, and we are joined once again, as usual, by Brother Henry from Seattle. What's up, Brother Henry?
Hi, everybody. Hey, D. Well, I just came from an interesting thing. You know the Tea Party group? Well, another group formed called the Coffee Party. Did you read about that? Maybe you did. Anyway, I got an email saying, could I come to this meeting? So I went, and there were 50 people at it. And this was a beginning organizing meeting, and I was trying to find out what it is and what they're trying to do. And it was very interesting because it's like diametrically opposed to the Tea Party in a lot of ways. They want to go for health care for everybody and do away with don't ask, don't tell. And anyway, sort of very interesting. And I don't know what will come of it, but I was surprised to see 50 people in the room here, and this is in the University District in Seattle.
The Tea Batters, they're those folks. It's like a bunch of extreme right-wing kind of libertarian-minded groups, you know, right, who are coming together and like uniting to try and what's the deal with them? I haven't read up on it a whole lot.
Well, they originally got their funding from a rich guy who owns who was CEO of a big healthcare company, and they are a movement. It feels like a movement of people that's growing, and they support right-wing causes. When I walked around among them in Olympia at the Capitol a couple of weeks ago, they had signs that ranged all the way from anti-abortion to it's all the immigrants' fault, to get government off our backs and no more taxes. And when I said, oh, what we're here for is to get legislation to tax rich people and corporations to pay for health care for everybody, they thought I was like from another planet. And I thought they were from another planet. Anyway, it just shows the polarization and the fact that it is good for people on the left or with a left persuasion to be able to start working together. You know, the fascists in Germany, they came out of a movement. It wasn't just, you know, Hitler saying do this, do that. There was a big reaction movement, and so I think we need to watch out for this and organize against it.
Radicalized rednecks. Organizing. That is a scary, scary, scary thought. Well, do you think we can all be strong like Rachel Corrie and organize ourselves to do something about this?
Well, I think so. I think there's really not an alternative, and different people jump into it for different reasons. The guy sitting next to me a little while ago had been out of work for 18 months, and he finally got a job. And other people are really worried about health care.
Higher education.
It's getting an education. There was one fellow was 18 years old just out of high school, and he wants to be able to go to college, and he's worried about is there money for that.
Well, Students for a Democratic Society, which is one of the organizations that did a whole lot of anti-war organizing in the 60s and is now coming together to do some student organizing against the war here in the millennium, has called for March 15th through the 20th to be a week of direct action and protest and everything else to end war worldwide, so that we can have all those resources that would be spent on war being spent on those resources aren't spent, money is
right,
spent, but resources being used on higher education, healthcare, all these things that we need. And I sure do hope that people can wake up a little bit and realize that we have to do something about this now, because otherwise, you know, the Tea Batters are going to, you know, do what they're going to do.
Yeah, I think that's really good. And is there going to be a march in Olympia? Well, the 15th is Monday, right? Is this coming week, is there a march, an anti-war march, do you know?
There
probably some kind of demonstration?
There more than likely is. I've been kind of laying low just a little bit, you know. So
okay.
I'm a slight bit out of the loop, but I would hope that there is.
Okay. Well, I know a couple things coming up in Seattle on Monday from the labor movement. One is a march at a big Chase bank to oppose the bailouts to the banks and to get them to back off fighting legislation that regulates banks. And then that afternoon at Westlake Plaza, there's going to be another rally, and this one's called by the State Labor Council for jobs. Like 30 to 40% of construction workers are out of work. And so they're trying to get money out of the legislature for construction projects. Well, that's what they're going to be out there demanding. So I think there's some spark happening that is galvanizing this. And that's an answer to your question. Do you think people will fight back? I think people are going to find that they don't, that nobody's looking out for them. Yep. And so they need to stand up and fight back for themselves and their kids, families, parents, neighbors, all that.
Yep, we're not going to have too much of a choice before too long. So
it's amazing how bad it got. You know, if you just think back 4 or 5 years ago, who would have imagined all these foreclosures? 18 million people out of work. I mean, you just wouldn't have imagined it. And so it's really bad.
Yeah. It definitely is. I mean, I was looking at some statistics just a few minutes ago, and there's something like 100, and the percentage of homeless youth in Olympia has increased by like 139%, and this is at the same time that they are doing a city campaign to kind of clean up the homeless. They're going through a lot of the homeless camps, and they're going to be cleaning them up and all this. So things are getting really, really rough for most of us out there, you know?
Yes. And so what I want to do today is talk a little bit about the nature of the economic system.
I think that's a good idea. I think people should be enlightened about that sooner than later, so.
Okay. That there's, we live under a capitalist system, and I think the most important thing to realize is capitalism wasn't here always. It came. And economic systems come and they go. And what we need to do is hasten the departure of this one because it depends on exploitation. It depends on the man who owns the espresso shop calling the tune about what hours you're going to work and how much you're going to get paid and if you're going to get paid health care or not, rather than society ought to provide that. I heard a guy, a reporter who's studying healthcare, he was on the radio the other day, and he was talking about when he lived in England, and he got up one day and one of his kids had a bronchitis or something, and he called the public. And they said, oh, we'll send a doctor around there in a couple hours. And in a couple hours, knock on the door, doctor came, examined the child, prescribed something, and then left. No exchange of money, because it's all publicly paid for. And they just assume that if you're sick, then you're going to get taken care of.
Yeah, because it's a basic human necessity. I mean, I hear people in America say, the economy's crashing. We're not going to have any food because there's not any money. How are we going to eat? And I'm sitting there thinking, like, well, people don't eat money, you know?
Yeah.
You still have a backyard. Get yourself a garden hoe and plant yourself some tomatoes, you know. And people in America are kind of so deluded and have so much Maya crept over their vision by the capitalist propaganda machine that they don't even realize what's going on, you know.
Right, and you know the schools deliberately don't teach it, and in order to learn it, you've got to talk about it, and you got to read, and you got to gain an understanding. And once you have that understanding, it doesn't ever leave you.
Yeah.
In society, there are two classes of people. There's the class of people who own things. Like in the old days in England in 1500, let's say you made shoes, and you made really good shoes, and people would come to you and buy the shoes that you made. And then with the Industrial Revolution, somebody opened up a factory to make shoes. And they could make shoes that probably weren't as good and pretty as your shoes, but they could make shoes a lot cheaper.
Yep, and then they would.
Oh, they put you out of business.
They would hire you to make shoes, and then all of a sudden you work for them, and you have to depend on them to tell you when to go and leave work, and you have to depend on them for a paycheck and every other little thing.
And there you go. And the way they made you do that was by selling shoes cheaper and making sure that you couldn't eat unless you worked.
And it's just and the funny thing that I find is that, you know, we assume that our government is ran by, like, intelligible, smart people who know what's going on, considering that they've went to school for some odd years and they wear a suit and whatever. But the thing is, like, right now, the capitalists are trying to run all the homeless out of Olympia so that they can have an economy here. Yeah. But the thing is that poverty is the engine of capitalism. So if you have a capitalist society with the most vibrant economy is not going to eliminate homelessness, because capitalism needs the homelessness to function, you know?
It needs it for a couple reasons. One, it needs it to keep the rest of us scared that that'll happen to us. And it also needs it because management really likes to be able to have a pool of unemployed people to be able to grab when production goes up.
So if the people who run our government are intelligent people, and let's just, you know, they may or may not be, hopefully maybe one of them will show up on Air Olympia one day and we can judge that for ourselves. But if they are intelligent people, then I'm sure that they understand that homelessness and poverty is the engine that keeps capitalism functional in the way that capitalism is capable of being functional. And so if they understand that and they do in fact want to keep the capitalist free market system in place, then why would they make a campaign to end homelessness?
Well, wait. The campaign isn't to end homelessness. The campaign is to kick the homeless people out from so we can't see them.
Yeah, and put them in a different town.
Right.
If they really
wanted to end homelessness, that would be a good thing, right? Everybody would have a place to live.
Well, it could be a good thing, depending on if they wanted to end homelessness and keep the capitalist society in place, then that would be a good thing. But perhaps they are getting tired of the capitalist society as well.
Well, I don't think so. I think there's different levels of the capitalist society, and the folks who generally want to get the homeless out of the way, or in Seattle, the city council is considering making a law against what they call aggressive panhandling. And I just wrote a letter about that, and I said, look, if I lose my job, I lose my income, at least I can always ask people for a quarter. But now you're going to make it illegal to do that. That sucks.
Is this a statewide gentrification program, or is
Well, it's happening all over, and the drivers are generally downtown business who thinks people are scared away.
Yeah.
Who think customers are scared away, and also developers who are trying to sell property and they could get more for their property if it looks prettier.
Well, this is starting to make a little bit of sense to me. I mean, the state of Washington, you know, we have a rainforest here. I think that the state of Washington competes with parts of France every year to see who can make the best berries and all this. And so, if you're gonna have a capitalist hub, a green capitalist hub where you keep everything comfortable and friendly, then it might as well be the state of Washington, and we'll just move all the homeless people down to Mississippi or somewhere like that.
I think it would be wonderful to have this a hub. I mean, what they would love to have is a workforce that would do exactly what they want when they want it, right? Oh, the blueberries are ripening. We need people to do the blueberries, but we don't want to pay them for the time when there's no blueberries. We don't even want them around when there's no blueberries. We want them to come, pick the blueberries, then be gone and go do something else. And so they like having this kind of migrant force. But I think something really important that's really Marxism 301 instead of 102 is, what's the nature of the state? What's the reason for the state? And it generally is that we've got a class system of the people who own stuff and the rest of us who work for them. And the function of the state is to help keep that arrangement.
Yep.
So the function of the state is to support the capitalists. And they've got to make some, in order to stay in business, kind of, the state has got to make some concessions to us so that we keep functioning.
Yeah, it's
that's really what its job is. And so when we demand stuff of the state, we're rightfully saying we want stuff back that's ours.
But
no, just on the thing about intelligent, because there's a lot of intelligent people, right? And a lot of rich people, at least when you get to Congress, to the Senate and the House, there's a lot of rich people up there and a lot of really smart people up there, and they like things the way they are.
And so, based on what you just said, I can say that the relationship between the governing elite and the governed, meaning the relationship between the people who make decisions in the state and everyone else, is basically they're gonna keep us as comfortable as they can get away with and still maximize profits. So when people start going and making demands from the government, like when people demand healthcare, when people demand higher education, and they demand these things from the government, do you think they should keep in mind that the government is only going to meet those demands insofar as they can continue to meet those demands and still maximize profits, or perhaps they might even minimize luxury, but they will only meet those demands insofar as they can continue to live a luxurious and privileged life and still meet those demands? And so is it, you know, this can only last so long, can it?
That's right. And in Germany, what happened was people were out in the streets demanding stuff, and the state, the government, couldn't really contain it, because all the state's got really is police, right? And if there's enough of us out there, the police and the state troopers can't really control us all. And so when the state fails to be able to control, what they want to do is try and mobilize people like the more rabid of the teabaggers. They try to mobilize a movement to come out against the working people. So that's why I use terms like, instead of just the people, I like to talk about the working people or the working class to distinguish us from the rich people and the folks who support them.
So I thought that the whole conspiratorial thinking was only a symptom of the youth, but are you suggesting that the teabaggers have been are kind of like an arm of the governing elite and the state, and that perhaps they have been inspired by certain government entities to do what they're doing?
Well, I think that they've been funded by some really rich people who want to prevent healthcare reform. But I think a lot of the sentiment can be mobilized, and I think that the right wing is interested in mobilizing them. And who's in there among them are the anti-immigrants and the fascists and the homophobes and the sexists, because when you walk among them, you can see the signs and the tables that people have.
Well, they sound like minions of Uncle Samael to me. So I think we're just about out of time. But wasn't there an event that you wanted to?
Thank you, sweet. Thank you, Dee. Yeah, tonight, sort of riffing off the Rachel Corrie that you talked about before, in New Freeway Hall in Seattle, in Columbia City, Radical Women is putting on an event celebrating International Women's Day, which was March 8th. And the main speakers are two. One is Nada Elia, who's a Palestinian and an organizer of the Israeli boycott campaign in the Northwest. And the other speaker is Adrienne Weller, who's Jewish, and she opposes Zionism. And she's a Jewish feminist who is active in the campaign to boycott Israel goods. So I hope people go to Radical Women website. You can see more about the event and come on out. There's a wonderful dinner that's going to be cooked by Ziad Zaitoun, who it's a Palestinian dinner at 6 o'clock, and then the forums at 7:30. So there's still time to get there from Olympia.
And this, I beguiled y'all. I pretended I didn't know anything about the event, but I actually have a flyer for it right here. It is at 5018 Rainier Avenue South at the new Freeway Hall. That is 5018 Rainier Avenue South. For more information, go to radicalwomen.org. And as soon as I can get some time off from bringing everybody all the anarchist news and analysis from Olympia of the Cascades, I'm going to come up there and attend one of these events. So let everybody know that Air Olympia wishes them the best, and I'll be up there soon.
Okay, great. It'd be lovely to see you. Thank you, Lot D. Bye-bye.
No problem, brother. See you later. That was Brother Henry Noble from Seattle. And we have just enough time to give you your wizard hint, your wizard tips for the week. And if you're going to be running around doing crazy stuff like trying to overthrow the American government and all that, you're going to have to be bad like Jesse James. You're going to have to be bad. You're going to have to know you're bad. And you're going to have to not care if anybody tells you that you're not bad. Okay? And so what people are going to do is, when you say things that they disagree with, they're not going to attack your argument because you're bad like Jesse James. You know, they're going to know that they can't attack your argument, and so they're going to attack you personally. And so if you have some kind of philosophy that you say, let's say that you are like, you know, capitalism is completely inadequate in terms of its ability to address the needs of the masses, and it is critical inevitability that capitalism will meet its end sooner than later. If you say something like that, people are going to say, hey, dude, why are you so arrogant? Why do you think you're right all the time? Why do you want to start stuff? Are you just an arrogant little poo-poo starter who always thinks that you're right all the time? And then you're going to say, well, why do you say I'm arrogant? And they're going to be like, because you're saying that you're right and I'm wrong. You're obviously arrogant. They'll be like, I'm going to ask you, do you think you're right? And then you'll say, yeah. Then they'll say, see, you're arrogant. You're saying that you're right. You're arrogant. Do-do-do-do-do. Well, guess what? If you were to ask Michael Jordan if he was a good basketball player, what would be more arrogant? Would it be more egotistical for him to say, I'm okay? That would be egotistical for him to say, I'm okay, because he's trying to appear humble. The proper answer, if you ask Michael Jordan if he's a good basketball player, is, dude, I'm freaking Michael Jordan. Come on now. You know? And so if you have an argument, if you are in a debate with someone and they begin to attack you personally rather than attack your argument, you just won. Okay? And it's not egotistical to say, hey, dude, you're too stupid to talk to me. Bye. That's what you say. You say, you're too stupid to talk to me. Be quiet until you get smarter. The egotistical route is to continue to debate with them because you want to try to prove a point because you're getting butthurt. So if you're going to be a revolutionary, you got to be bad like Jesse James, and you gotta brush those haters right off. And we'll see you tomorrow. And if you need some strength in helping you be bad like Jesse James, here you go. It's Air Olympia. Remember this.